decide what newspapers to read, you might concern yourself with whether the reporting is accurate, whether the reporters check their facts and have good reasons and evidence for what they say. But probably what's more important to you is what's in the newspaper. What does the newspaper consider newsworthy? And I am interested in analogous question about the mind. And I'm struck by the fact that in many areas of inquiry, probably all areas of inquiry really except philosophy, what is taken to be the most important is really the questions you're asking. So for example, in history, it's not just kind of taken for granted that you could write a history book that was full of true facts about what happened, but really the crucial thing would be which facts are you focusing on, which story are you telling? In the case of the social sciences, we're not just interested in evidentially well-supported research, we're interested in research that asks questions that matter, that are important in our stage of inquiry. In the case of experiments, it's not that hard to do, you know, a well-rigorous experiment, at least sometimes it isn't, but really what matters is which experiments are you doing. So you can find these same kind of two dimensions of evaluation, accuracy and well-foundedness on the one hand, but importance on the other, or relevance. And in the case of the newspaper, there's a kind of structure that signals what's more or less important. So there's a front page, and there's back page, and there are things in the middle, and the important stories, they go on the front page. I want to ask whether, I want to focus on a structure in the mind that's kind of analogous to the structure of the newspaper. So in the mind, the conscious mind, there's also a structure of kind of center and periphery. So attention is intrinsically kind of distributed across things. And some things are more central to attention and some things are more peripheral, just like some stories in the newspaper are on the front page and some are in the back page. So what I want to do in the short time that we have is to first identify a mental phenomenon that is the analogy of the newspaper, which I'm going to call a salient structure. And then I want to ask some normative questions about it and address those questions. So the questions are there norms, and not just social mores, but actual norms that govern salient structures? And if so, what kinds of norms might these be? So I have to tell you a little bit about what a salient structure is. So just as to fix ideas, and I'll say more about this later on, think of it as an ordering among the things you pay attention to. So those could be objects, they could be features, they could be your own thoughts. And it's an ordering according to the relative centrality or peripherality to a subject at a time. Now, there are clearly, so these are patterns of attention. And there are clearly social mores that concern what you should or shouldn't pay attention to. So you were probably told when you were little, it's impolite to stare, don't stare, it's impolite to stare. So that's a norm of attention. Or think about getting into a taxi cab and what are kind of admissible topics for conversation. This will differ culturally. A friend of mine who moved to Oslo for a while came to New York and he was charmed because he got in the taxi cab and the first thing the driver said to him was, "Would you like to hear a riddle?" And that was a New York experience. That wouldn't happen, he claimed, in Oslo. So you know what topics are socially acceptable to talk about. Negligence in the law sometimes reports to track actual moral claims, but often, you know, it's an open question whether it does. So, you know, if you leave your dog in the car on a hot day and, you know, you just forgot and your dog dies, that's a problem. You weren't paying attention the way you should have, even if, you know, maybe you have a good explanation for why you didn't pay attention. It doesn't matter. You're still responsible for your dog. Okay, so those are some examples of social norms, social mores that govern attention. And the norms I'm trying to ask about are not, or at least not fundamentally, social mores. So I'm trying to ask about the kind of culturally unspecific norms, the kind that's supposed to figure in morality or epistemology or practical reasoning. I want to know, are there salience norms in that sense? Because we already know that there are kind of social mores governing salience. But I want to know if there are salience norms. And when I'm thinking through this question, I find it helpful to distinguish these three different parameters along which you might locate potential salience norms. So one question is about the intrinsic status of those norms. So we could ask, are they prudential? So a norm that is prudential, that's a kind of intrinsic feature of the norm. And then a different parameter concerns what the salience norms govern. So by definition, they govern what I'm calling salient structures, and I promise to tell you more about that, what those are. But do they govern anything else besides salient structures? Like, do they govern actions, for example, or anything else? And then as a third parameter, which is about the relational status of these norms, meaning do the salience norms derive from other kinds of norms, such as they just fall out of the moral laws or the moral principles, or do they derive from other epistemic norms? Now, when we ask what kind of norms govern what should be more or less salient to you, what you should pay more or less attention to, one idea that comes to mind right away is that there are prudential norms. So, for example, if you want to see a bird because you're a bird watcher, there are certain places you should look, and then there are certain places you shouldn't look. Don't look in the refrigerator. It's not a good place to go bird watching. So given your goal of seeing a bird, you should look where birds are likely to be. So that's a prudential norm. It speaks to an antecedent goal that you have. And now, it's another type of norm that might occur to you that I want to discuss with you is one that derives from, derives from the domain of ethics. So according to Aristotle or virtue theorists, if you read in this area, you'll be familiar with the idea from Iris Murdoch, from John McDowell, that part of having a good character is knowing what to notice, or noticing the things that matter morally. Now, you need the right kind of susceptibilities in perception already, according to Aristotle and some thinkers who derived him. So that's a kind of potential salience norm. It tells you what to pay attention to. It predicts that if you already have a certain kind of character, then certain things will be salient to you. Now, here's an example of a salience norm that derives from another kind of normative pressure. The normative pressure should be good. And here its domain is action as well as salient structures. And that norm that you find in some virtue ethics, it's what I'm going to call an importance norm, because it says that what you should pay attention to is what's important for good action. Now, prudential norms are not importance norms. You can see this from thinking about what life would be like if there was no sewer or a fire department. So if there's no fire department, it might be important to pay attention to the possibility of fire because you're kind of on your own. Given that there is a fire department, you can then pay attention to other things. But protecting yourself against fire or getting dressed, it's important to get dressed. But once you've done it, that's kind of taken care of. So it's very important to get dressed, especially in the winter. It's very important. But from the fact that it's important, it just doesn't follow. In fact, it's prudentially important. It doesn't follow that you should, it should be more salient. So prudential norms are not importance norms. Okay. So it seems like there's at least one salience norm. So we have our first bit of an answer to the question, are there salience norms? Which is that there are prudential norms, and I'm saying it's not an importance norm. Now, perhaps there's also importance for good action norms. And the conclusion that we're aiming for in this paper, which is, by the way, joint work with Sebastian Watzel, who is none other than the person who was asked a riddle in the taxi in New York, we are arguing that there are two other salience norms besides these, and that neither of them is prudential, and that both are, in some very broad sense, epistemic norms. Okay, so that is the conclusion of this paper. There are epistemic salience norms, and neither of them are prudential. So I'm just going to list the norms that I want to eventually tell you about, and then I will back up and start to go through this whole thing in more detail. So the first norm that we think there is one that is another kind of importance norm that I'm going to call the importance for understanding norm. So according to this norm, what's relatively more important for understanding should be more salient in the mind. So we think of this as a kind of fittingness norm. It's not derivative, meaning there's no other norm from which this one derives. And its domain covers both salient structures, of course, but also what you might call epistemic actions, like inquiry. And then the second salience norm that we're going to suggest there is something I'm going to call epistemic branching, an epistemic branching norm. And here, the outlooks that you have in your mind, the kind of presumptions or
theories or perspectives you have on the world, which can be rational or irrational, those can include in their manifestations the salient structures of it, is what you pay attention to, what you don't pay attention to. And when that happens, the salient structures themselves, your distribution of attention, can inherit the rational or irrational status of the outlook that it is manifesting. So here, this norm would be derivative in the sense of the epistemic norm governing the outlook, like, for example, a cluster of belief, would also govern the salient structure that it gives rise to, and its domain would include those outlooks as well as the salient structure. Okay, so there's two positions in this area that I want to contrast. So there's the only two view, which says the only salience norms are prudential norms and the importance for good action norm. And we're defending what I'm going to call the all four view, just to, so we can count these norms, which says that besides those two salience norms, there are these two other ones that I just mentioned. Now, obviously, there are other positions in between. It's not meant to be exhaustive, but those are the positions I want to focus on. Okay. Now, I want to say a little bit about where this question about salience norms is coming from, beyond what I've already said. There's a picture in epistemology, which will be familiar to you, which divides things up like this. It says that the normatively evaluable mental states include beliefs, which are governed by epistemic norms, intentions and actions, which are governed by practical norms, and maybe some emotions like fears, which would be reasonable or unreasonable. And on the standard picture, the moral and the other practical norms, you know, they're governing intentions and actions, and the epistemic ones are governing beliefs. But where do we put inquiry on the standard picture? Where do we put the practice of deciding what questions you want to address, which propositions you want to have an opinion about? Where do we put that? Well, on the standard picture, that kind of falls exclusively on the practical side. So if you think about evidentialism, the position that says that the epistemically rational beliefs are exactly the ones that fit the evidence, how you got your evidence, what kind of process of inquiry you went through to get it, not supposed to matter to the epistemic standing of the belief. What matters is how well you respond to the evidence you have. So all kinds of things would have happened to determine which evidence you have. But once you have it, you know, the rationality of your belief depends only on how well it fits the evidence you have. So Bayesianism, for example, is a theory like this, and I mentioned some other evidentialists on the handout. And so on this picture, when we ask what the dimensions of epistemic evaluability are, the answer is, well, your beliefs, can be true or false, and it's better if they're true, and then they can be kind of well-founded, well-supported by the evidence, or less well-supported by the evidence, whatever that comes to. But if you ask, well, what should you pay attention to? You know, what question should you try to answer? That's kind of, you know, you get shunted off to this other department. Well, that's the practical department. It just depends on what you want, depends on your goals. But there are supposed to be questions about action, not about belief, not supposed to be epistemic questions at all. Okay, so we think that this standard view gets it wrong about the domain of epistemic normativity, because it ignores two kinds of salience norms that are epistemic, and it mischaracterizes norms of inquiry as exclusively prudential. Okay, so that is where I'm going. Now let me go in a little bit more detail over this question, what kinds of norms might govern salience structure. So if there are salience norms, and they're going to concern facts like the ones I've put on the bottom of page 3. So the fact that to a subject, the Fs are more salient than the Gs, X is more salient than Y, X is salient rather than peripheral or altogether off the radar, unregistered. And then some sentences involving normative language will be true if there are salience norms. So I've written some of those down too, such as that the subject should have a different salient structure, or that she should attend more to the Y than to more to X than to Y, or at least that it's recommended that she should, or better she should, or be inappropriate if she didn't, or if she did. Now, there always have to be interpretations of the normative words that occur in such sentences. So there will just be some interpretations of those words if sentences like these are true, which they will be if there are salience norms. And I'm not actually sure what normative language really, truly, is best for posing these questions. So I'm just going to kind of use should as a placeholder, but perhaps different language would be better. You can tell me what you think about that. And then another question that arises about the salience norms is whether we think about them as kind of regulative ideals that are guiding our behavior, or whether we instead think of them as just telling us what the contours of epistemic appropriateness are really like. So we're thinking of it in the latter way. What you should actually do is going to depend on a whole bunch of complicated other factors. So from the fact, for example, that there's some normative pressure to pay more attention to the X's and the Y's, you can't read off from that that, okay, this person should pay more attention to the X's and the Y's, because maybe there are other, for example, prudential considerations that pull in the opposite direction, or something like that. Okay, so we're thinking of salience norms as issuing in these pro tanto rational pressures to distribute your attention in one way rather than another. Good. Now, I told you I'd tell you more about what salience structures are, so let me talk about that by first distinguishing some different varieties of attention. So in the case of perception, there are different kinds of perceptual attention. You can pay attention to objects, you can pay attention to features, properties, redness, for example. You can pay attention to spaces and just attend to whatever happens in that space. Watch the space for more information. And then there are other types of attention that are not exclusively perceptual. So you can, you know, think about your plans for tomorrow or yesterday's high point. You can feel a pang of laughter or hunger in your feet and your shoes. So those are other kinds of attention. Now, salient structures cross-cut all of these different varieties. So relative to a kind of attention, something like X is more attended. To say that something is more attended, well, whenever X is more attended, the state of attending to X is more salient, as we're talking about salience. So both mental and non-mental things can be salient. So if you see, you know, you see a bear and it's standing on the ground, and then the bear is probably more salient to you than the ground that it's standing on. But there's going to be some psychological state that you have that's intentionally directed toward the bear, and that psychological state will be more central in your mind than the psychological state that's directed toward the grass. And if you don't have any psychological state directed toward the grass, even more so, it's even more, you know, then it's even less salient. It's off the radar completely. Now, the notion of salience occurs in different disciplines and different forms of inquiry, and I think there are some differences to be found. So, for example, psychologists, they often talk about salience as a bottom-up feature. So something counts as salient only if it grabs your attention, like that fire alarm did before. So on that way of thinking about salience, nothing could be salient if you chose to focus on it. So that's not what we're talking about. It's different from our feature. Linguists sometimes talk about salience in conversation, where there could be like a salient option that was overlooked or a salient reference. It doesn't mean that someone's paying attention to it. Maybe someone missed the salient thing. So again, that doesn't have this tight connection between attention and salience that we are focusing on. So our notion of salience links salience to attention in the way that I described. Okay, and so just as some, you know, attention is always distributed, and the salient structure is a notion that helps us describe the distribution of attention of all the kinds that I mentioned before. So some things are in the background, the periphery, other things are in the foreground. So some situations or people or possibilities of interactions with people are going to be more salient to you than others, and then other possibilities of interaction or people or things won't be salient at all. Okay, one last distinction, and then we'll start talking about the norms. So we could talk about a person's salient structure at a time, which is an ordering of their attentional states according to their relative periphery or centrality. You could relativize it to just one kind of attention or all. When we talk about the ordering, we're not meaning to say that there's some kind of numerical scale or anything, and I say incremental, but even that might be a stretch if you think that increments can't be continuous. So that's just a comparative ordering. Something's more salient than something else. It's all that's happening. No fancy technology. But we could also think about diachronic salient structures. So that's a sequence of synchronic salient structures, but it's a useful notion because it lets you describe the frequency of something over, you know, across synchronic salient structures. Like when you dwell on something, your mind keeps coming back to something. But in that, you know, you dwell on this bad possibility that's looming, or that you think is looming. That's just like you think about it on Monday, you think about it on Wednesday, you think about it on Friday. You know, you could just think about it on Monday and be done with it. But if you think about it often, then it's occurring in your diachronic salient structures, diachronically salient. Okay, so what I want to do on the dialectical part of the paper is first just review some cases and considerations that lead people to think that really the only kinds of salience norms are the prudential ones and possibly importance for good action. And then I want to focus on the considerations that move us to think that really there's more norms than just those. Okay, so a first idea that motivates the picture on which salience is just prudential and perhaps also relates to importance for good action, focuses on salient structures which you don't control. So oftentimes your attention is just grabbed by things. And if you asked, well, should you listen to that beep? You know, you think, well, I don't know. I mean, you just did. It beeped and you couldn't help but pay attention to it. So it just seems like it's kind of a poor question if you say, well, you know, you noticed the turtle. Should you have noticed the turtle? Like, I just noticed the turtle. You know, leave me alone. I'm pointing to familiar types of factors that lead to salient structures where it just doesn't seem like the subject is exercising any rationality or agency or anything. So you might think, how could the normative notions get any grip on a phenomenon that was like that? Other examples of this involve associations, so movements of the mind from one thought to another, like your thoughts about Christmas trigger your thoughts about snow, or words sometimes just trigger other words, especially if you read or write poetry. Your thoughts can be fueled by rhythm and rhyme. You know, how many people will fit in this room? How many days till next full moon? You know, you think this, and then you think the other thing just because of the mere rhythm of it. Or your mind might just wander without any direction at all, sometimes uncontrollably. So this is the working of a diachronic salient structure. First you're paying attention to this, sometimes you're paying attention to that, and if your mind is just moving in this way through these forces, you might think again that at most there could be kind of an instrumental value to these things. So if you were trying to avoid, you know, if you were hoping, you wishing this conversation would end and then the fire alarm goes off, then that's good. But if you ask, like, well, should you have silently thought drip after drop, or drop after drip, again, it seems like a poor question. Okay, so the only two of you can, you know, accommodate these observations straightforwardly. You know, there's a lot of kind of normative freebies when it comes to what is in the mind. Now, there are other salient structures that might initially seem better or worse in kind of more complicated ways. And so now I want to look at what the only two of you can say about those. So first example is about optimism and pessimism. So the pessimistic salient structures, they kind of foreground the disconnection between people and sadness and doom and gloom and emptiness, unlikelihood of causes for celebration. Whereas the optimistic salient structure, it foregrounds different things. You know, beauty and cheer and hope and possibility of better days and the ease of connection between people. And you could ask, and some social psychologists have asked, which is better? You know, just tell us which is better, optimist or pessimist? So that's a kind of normative question of some sort. And by the way, what the psychologists say is if you're a pessimist, then you can always be pleasantly surprised. So some people have this as a kind of defense. You know, if you're an optimist, obviously it mobilizes you. But you can just see kind of trade-offs, like it mobilizes you, but you might not really see the deep, you know, fundamental value your activities have, or whether they, you might not ask whether they do have those kind of deep values. And then, of course, in the pessimism case, you know, it's kind of useful for reflection, but it's bad for mobilizing you to act. If you think that salience norms are prudential, then, you know, it just kind of depends on your situation. You know, one can be more better than the other if, you know, you're in a place where you really want to reflect on things, and pessimism, fine. If you're kind of want to be more getting things done, then maybe you should be an optimist. But it seems like there's a decent answer from the point of view of the prudentialist about whether it's better to be optimistic or pessimistic. And if you ask what does the importance for good action norm say about optimism and pessimism, it might, you know, perhaps it might require in specific situations optimism or pessimism, but it doesn't seem like it requires overall optimism or pessimism. So whatever normative facts there might be so far that we've noticed with these ways of being, it seems like they can be accounted for by the only two of you. Okay, here's another type of salient structure that you might think admits of evaluation in a way that just mere association or thoughts running through your mind does not. And that has to do with the stability or instability of attention. So there is this person X who just can't focus for very long on anything. His mind goes from one thing to the next thing. And, you know, that can be bad for some things. Like, you know, it's hard to do a kind of big extended task if you're like that all the time. And you have a very undemanding relationship to the world. You just kind of focus on whatever passes by and nothing else. Now, you can picture prudential grounds on which instability can be bad, because maybe you really want to do something that requires extended focus, like Sudoku. You know, you have to actually focus on it for a bit. So if you had an unstable salient structure, it would not be good for Sudoku. Okay, so there's the prudential norm again. Or take the small toddler who just cannot decide which shoe to put on first and is kind of paralyzed with indecision. So if you're in charge of this toddler, you know, you think, he's probably right. I mean, there is no good reason to put the left rather than the right. That's true. But there is just overriding prudential consideration. You just pick one, because that way you'll get your shoes on. So that's a little bit different from Sophie, as in Sophie's Choice, who can't decide which of her two daughters to save. So here she's very agitated, and she has this instability you could picture, which makes her inefficacious, just like the toddler is made inefficacious. But it's different, because her indecision kind of fits the excruciating situation. So she might have prudential reason to just pick, but that doesn't make her instability of which one, any less fitting. Why? Well, here it seems like it's because of the importance for good action norm. They're kind of equally important, and that's why instability meets the norm that says, you know, what's more important should be more salient. Okay, these two things are equally important. They should be equally salient. If they're equally salient, you know, maybe given the constraints that you're in, you can't choose. So maybe she's meeting this importance norm even if she's not being efficacious. Okay, so it seems like at least when you avail yourself of the prudential norm and importance for good action, you can actually account for this salient structure, which seems to be a valuable. These two kinds of instability that are valuable in different ways. Okay, here's another example. Say there's some hiring committee, and they're reading applications from socially stigmatized candidates, but they harbor unconscious prejudice against them. So there's lots of things that we know happens in these kinds of situations, but let's just focus on the manifestation of it, where this committee is kind of unwittingly, they don't know this is happening, but they're unwittingly focusing just on the weakest part of the at-group applications. They're not really fully processing the strongest parts. They're kind of selecting evidence, though they don't mean to be, but this is what's happening because of their prejudice. They're selecting evidence that's congruent with their prejudice. They're anti-selecting evidence that's incongruent with it. And then they're like, it seems like a weak candidate. What are you supposed to do? Hire the weak candidate? Of course not. So here they have a kind of local salient structure in their overalls. You know, there's a local salient structure that just concerns the application. And again, the prudential norm says, look, in fact, this is what Mazarine Banaji says when she goes and, you know, hundreds of people, she talks about implicit bias and its effects. And she says, the reason that you should try to get control of this phenomenon and learn about it and know about it is because you will be very poor at recognizing talent. If you don't, you're going to miss the talented people. This is not a good way of getting talented people into your organization. So that is a prudential defense of, you know, prudential critique of this kind of salient structure. Okay, I'm going to give you one more example before I start talking about why we think there's more than just these two salient norms. So this concerns death. So there are these two people, and they're in identical circumstances, and they like the same things, and they're kind of both generally prone to serious reflection, and they're about to die. So one person, you know, feels brave. They're seized by the sense of gravitas because, you know, she's thought a lot about death and read reflections on death in literature and philosophy, and now she's finally at the horizon of death herself. And she wants to think about her experience, her new experience, which is soon going to end, of being close to death. Then there's the other person. The other person asks for cupcakes. She loves cupcakes. They're colorful and they're cheerful and they're charming, and she'd like to share some cupcakes with people and talk about, you know, the difference between their texture and their frosting and how they look on the plate, and, you know, compare and contrast and speculate about what gives them that texture. So, you know, we can set aside whether one person's good or not. It doesn't seem like moral character is particularly relevant in this case. And you might think that if there were any non-prudential norms that speak to salient structures, you would expect it would speak to what happens in these especially grave situations. But of all times to regulate somebody's attention, it kind of seems like this was another normative freebie. You know, it kind of, you shouldn't regulate them. If you want cupcakes. If they want to reflect. But it just seems wrong to impose like cupcakes on a serious person or seriousness on the cupcake person. And if it seems wrong, then according to the only two of you, the reason it's wrong is because it's just not how the dying mind wants to be occupied. It wants to be occupied one way, it should be occupied that way, and that's kind of all there is to it. It's not, you know, it's not like there's some other norm that's pressuring you in one way or another. Either one is really, really okay. Okay, So what I've done so far is give you some salient structures that just kind of seem like off the grid of evaluation and shown, you know, made the case that like at most there's prudential considerations about whether you should or shouldn't have salient structures like that. And then I considered some other salient structures that don't seem like just, you know, they don't seem like freebies in the same way, or anyway, they're not things that arise just like a loud bang. But it looks like these two salience norms, importance for good action, and the prudential norms kind of speak to the normative situation. So perhaps that's all there is. Okay, now I want to start to look a little bit more critically on this position. And there's kind of two things you could do if you wanted to criticize this position. So one thing you could do is just kind of consider what other salience norms there could be. And another thing you could do is to maybe go back to some of those situations and see whether they leave anything out. Those two norms that I mentioned really leave anything out. So are there aspects of those either jarring or kind of laudatory salient structures that can't be analyzed in terms of instrumental or prudential, I should say, value or disvalue, or what's important for a good person to notice? Okay, so my hypothesis, so I'm going to do both of those things. And I'm going to start with instability, so the case of having an unstable salient structure. So take some school kid who just can't focus because he's not interested in the classroom material. And really, this case is best presented in dialogue form. So you have these kind of idealistic parents of this kid. And the parents think this kid's inability to pay attention is actually a fitting response to a boring environment. So they go to complain to the school administrator. And they say, my kid can't pay attention. There's something wrong with the classroom. And the administrator says, your kid has attention deficit disorder and like prescribes some medication. You should go get some medication and medicate him. And then the parents are like, come on, the kid is bored out of his mind. Don't medicate him. You should improve the curriculum. Give him something interesting to pay attention to. Okay, and then the administrator tries to be very honest. He says, look, what the kid is supposed to be learning is how to focus, per se. That's what's important for the kid to learn. And actually, a boring curriculum is just as good as an interesting curriculum. It doesn't matter. What matters is that they're trying to learn how to pay attention to. What we're teaching here is focus. Okay, now, the kid and the parent, let's just suppose the kid is, it doesn't matter, but the parent is basically appealing to an idea of that what's important for understanding should be more salient. So they think if nothing in the environment is actually important to understand, then the salient structure should be unstable because nothing's more important than anything else. You're just kind of in this pit of boringness. So instability is fitting in that situation. For all that, it might be unproductive, it might not train you to do anything, but that doesn't make it ill-fitting. Just like, you know, Sophie is kind of inefficacious and unproductive too, not saving anybody, but that doesn't mean her response isn't fitting. Sometimes an analogous point is made when people talk about anger. You know, anger is unproductive, don't get angry. And it might be unproductive, but that doesn't make it less fitting. It might still fit the situation. Okay, so here I'm displaying a case where it seems like there is a different norm from the ones we've been talking about, importance for understanding. In a way, an extension of this example comes from the idea of cultural authority, by which I mean authority that purports to identify things that are just worth learning, ideas that are worth considering, histories that are worth trying to reconstruct, creations that are worth beholding, things in the art museum, problems that are worth solving, where these things are worth doing, even independently of any antecedent social purpose. So even if you don't already have as your goal to solve this problem, it's actually worth it to try to solve the problem. And that's kind of a premise to approaches, premise of the university. It's also a premise to many approaches to other kinds of education, too, that there are some books and ideas and artworks and problems that are worth paying attention to, even if you don't antecedently have an interest in them, or an interest to be interested in the things that society deems important. You could have like none of those interests, but there would still be this worthwhileness to paying attention to them. They would be important for understanding. So on that approach, the idea is that the problems and the artworks and the books and so on, the ideas, they produce a kind of pro tanto rational pressure to pay attention to them, whether or not you know anything about them in the first place. So canons are supposed to be repositories of cultural authority. And you're, most of you, too young to remember this, but there was, in the 80s and 90s, there were the canon wars in literature, which has, you know, really changed the way literature was taught, at least in the United States. And those were debates about what belonged in the canon. So literature departments used to, well, I won't tell you how it was, but I'll just tell you that the debates presupposed the idea of a canon. They argued about what belonged in them, but the idea that there was a canon, there was such a thing as cultural authority, that was just a presupposition of the debate. Okay, so here too we have the idea of there's something that is worth paying attention to and produces a protanto pressure to pay attention to it. It's not prudential and not obviously connected to importance for good action. Okay, now let's return to optimism and pessimism, because I believe that something is left out from the only two view in the treatment of these moods, approaches, outlooks in life. So what is the difference between the optimist and the pessimist? Well, the pessimist treats drastic possibilities as nearby, kind of looming, and they're pressing. Whereas the optimist treats the kind of hopeful possibilities as nearby and cheer-making, and they also treat the drastic possibilities as just, they're not nearby. Now, what kind of nearby are we talking about? You know, well, we don't necessarily just have to be talking about how likely they are. You can have an optimist and a pessimist who agree about the unlikeliness of the plane to crash or something bad of happening, but the pessimist keeps thinking about it. So that's the diachronic salient structure lets us describe this again. The pessimist keeps thinking about it. The optimist is just like, yeah, it might happen, but they're not dwelling. It's not occupying their mind. It's not salient to them. So the way to even characterize the sense in which one type of possibility is nearby, the types of possibilities that are nearby for the optimist and pessimist differ, we should characterize that kind of nearbyness precisely in terms of salience. And then we can ask whether the kind of fittingness of pessimism and optimism just is a matter of like your beliefs about how likely something is. It seems like the answer is no, for the reason I just tried to go through. So it's not just that, you know, you got to have the true beliefs about how likely something is. It's rather that what we're asking when we ask whether optimism or pessimism is more fitting is whether those possibilities are worth paying attention to. Are the bad possibilities worth paying attention to as much as the pessimist pays attention to them, or should they be background? And of course, the optimist could also be at fault. You know, maybe in some situations, the optimist is, you know, it's sort of seems like a bad thing to say. Don't be so optimistic. You know, if the situation is really horrible, like climate change, you know, climate change, this is not paid very much attention to, you know, in the ways that you might expect, given what it actually is about. So you might think that it's just not fitting to be optimistic in this case, not because you kind of have the modalities wrong, just because you're not taking it seriously enough. Okay. Death and cupcakes. So the idea that there is a norm that says that what's more important for understanding should be more salient and what's less important for understanding should be less salient, that can explain the death and cupcakes example, because death actually is more important to understand than cupcakes. Now that doesn't mean that, you know, the cupcake person should be paying attention to the other thing, because I was saying before, from the fact that there is some salience norm that says X is more important to pay attention to than Y, pay more attention to X than Y, you can't read off from that what someone should actually do. So maybe there's kind of countervailing considerations. But there's a kind of pro tanto pressure to understand death, and there is no corresponding pressure to like understand cupcakes. Maybe the thing to do for you for all that is to think about cupcakes, but that's just the way it might be. It doesn't show anything, that doesn't show that there's not an importance for understanding norm. Okay, how much time do I have, Tim?
5 minutes.
Okay. I don't have time to go through the other epistemic norm, but I will endeavor. I will tell you the example, and I will let you see if you can reconstruct it if you want to ask me about it. So I want to give you an example about an associative movement of the mind. In this case, it's a movement between concepts, sometimes between thoughts involving concepts. So Jennifer Eberhardt, is a psychologist at Stanford, she did a whole series of experiments that she thinks show that there's a two-way association in the minds of American adults between concepts. She says black, but I believe it's black man because all the experiments are with men, and the concept of crime. So these are priming cases. So given a black male crime, crime-related objects become more salient I can tell you about the experiment if you want to know how they made more salient. Given a crime prime, black faces are more salient. So on the face of it, this isn't, what is elicited in the experiments isn't on the face of it any kind of thought, you know, attributing criminality or danger or threat to black men. What's elicited is rather just the mind moves from one thing to another. When you see a black male face, then crime-related objects more salient. When you see like a pair of handcuffs or a police badge, then black faces are more salient on it. It's called a dot probe task. I can tell you that if you want to know. Okay. So now, if we just look at the movement of a mind from one thing to another, then you might think, like in our examples of associations before between drip and drop, you know, how could that be something that, you know, was epistemically better or worse? It's just forced you thinking about one thing, then you're thinking about something else. What's wrong with that? The epistemic branch, but when you think about this case, you think, well, there does seem to be something. I don't know what exactly is wrong, but it certainly makes people feel uneasy to hear these results. Why? Why does it make them uneasy to feel the results? Well, it makes them uneasy to learn about these results. They're horrible results. They should make you want to cry. Why? Because those transitions in the mind are manifesting a stereotype that's central to a kind of racism that's been in the U.S. for a long time. And that stereotype really does do the predicative thing that the association by itself doesn't seem to do, which it attributes to black men and boys the properties of being dangerous, threatening, violent, aggressive, prone to threaten the public, which is just another way of saying prone to crime. So when we ask what's the relationship between this stereotypical outlook that's underneath the associations, we don't have a name for that relationship, but it's a little bit like fingers on a hand. The fingers are the associative movements, and the hand is the whole thing, the outlook plus the association. And the epistemic branching norm lets us see not just use this metaphor of fingers on a hand, but we could see the relationship between the association and the outlook as something like a basing relation, meaning that if the outlook is irrational, then there's a sense in which the association is too. If you had the exact same association, but it wasn't connected to the outlook because you weren't embedded in a society in which this view was so deeply entrenched, then it would be fine. So if you feel pulled in two directions as to, is there anything epistemically wrong with thinking this and then thinking that? Well, yes, because it just smacks, just smacks of something bad. But no, because it's just an association. The way you can explain both directions is by saying that if you had a world in which someone's mind really was just moving from this to that as a one-off thing, then it would be fine. But your sense that it's bad is there because it is manifesting something that's much more articulated. And the epistemic branching norm lets you put your finger on that, lets you identify what the normative pressure is. So again, this has nothing to do with prudence. It has nothing to do with good or bad character, at least I submit. So this is a norm that governs diachronic salient structures. Because the movement of the mind from one thing to another shapes the diachronic salient structures. Okay, in prejudicial hiring, you could ask whether anything else is wrong with this kind of anti-selection of the anti-selection of evidence that favors the socially stigmatized group, besides the consequence that Mazarin Banaji focuses on of not identifying talent. Well, the epistemic branching norm lets you say there is something wrong, which is that that pattern of attention inherits a poor epistemic status from the prejudice it's helping to generate. Okay. I need to stop now. Okay, I will stop.